Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the list of names in the obituaries. Today's list includes the following: Rufus Bastian, Patrick Bronde, Rex Brewster, Randy Burson, Barbara Crisp, David Martin Dobash, Paul Elsner, Georgine Lucy Gorzen, Judy Hossick, Christina Renshaw, Debbie Skiff, Janet Soper, Larry Dean Swanberg, Anne McLean Tollickson, and Lucy Tryman. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. There's two articles on this page. The first one: Your declined card may be AI's fault. This was what was written. Apparently it's by Pragati Awashthi from Drexel University, published in their paper called The Conversation. Here's what she wrote. Imagine you are at the supermarket checkout. Your cart is full. The line behind you is long. You tap your card. Declined. You try it again. Declined. Now, you haven't overspent. You haven't done anything suspicious. But somewhere inside your bank's computer systems, a machine made a decision about you in less time than it takes to blink. And it made a mistake. Now, why did that just happen? And why does it keep happening to people who haven't done anything wrong? This isn't a rare glitch, but something that happens to millions of people every day. And most of us have no idea why it happens or what we can do about it. But the answer lies inside a fraud detection system that is powered by AI. As a data science teaching professor and a former financial services data scientist, I understand how this system works, and I can explain why it sometimes fails the very customers that it is meant to protect. But just as important, I can help you find out what you need to know and what you can do if you or your loved ones are unfairly flagged. When you tap a card, a signal travels to your bank's fraud detection system just in the time it takes to blink. The transaction processing at your checkout is fully automated, operating within AI systems that handle millions of payments simultaneously, and it computes a risk score based on dozens of features that are extracted from that one single moment. Those features might include the transaction amount relative to your recent spending average, or the type of merchant, or your geographic location, or the time of day, or the device used for online purchases, and how this purchase compares to your historical patterns. Once those factors are plugged in, an algorithm scores your purchase in real time. A model, trained on millions of past transactions, then assigns each combination of features a probability on how likely it is that this transaction would be fraudulent. And if that probability crosses a threshold, the transaction is blocked or flagged for review. And that whole process takes less than 200 milliseconds. Well, what sets this technology apart is speed. Financial institutions process millions of transactions every day, which is far greater than any human team can effectively monitor. Banks also have fraud analysts, but their work happens at a different layer entirely. They review patterns, investigate cases, and handle disputes that the automated system escalates to them. To their credit, These new systems are usually accurate at catching fraud. Banks lose far less money due to card fraud today than they did before machine learning, which is one of the foundational technologies that powers today's AI systems and becoming standard. But still, the word accurate conceals the problem. Let's consider the number. The Federal Trade Commission reported that Americans lost more than $12.5 billion to fraud in 2024. That's a 25% increase from the year before. As banks process more transactions than ever, fraudsters are keeping pace too. And here is the part that is especially worth noting. According to Stripe, which is one of the world's largest payment processors, quote, false declines, now those are legitimate transactions wrongly rejected, false declines are a structural problem across the entire industry. And industry research consistently suggests that they cost the financial system more than the actual fraud does. These errors are not random. They cluster around people and situations that the algorithm was not properly trained to expect. Buying gas in a city that you've never visited, or making a large rent payment for the first time, are not inherently suspicious. But to a machine that has been trained on past patterns, they sure can look that way. There is something even more troubling. These algorithms learn from historical data, which is almost always imbalanced. Because fraudulent transactions are rare on a per-transaction basis, the model has seen relatively few examples of what fraud looks like. So what does this mean? Research has found that customers in lower-income areas and communities of color face higher rates of erroneous declines. When a model has not seen enough transactions from a particular group of people or in a given situation, it has less data to build an accurate baseline for them. So when something slightly unusual happens, it flags it. Not out of intent, but out of unfamiliarity. The model isn't necessarily explicitly discriminating against anyone, but its outputs can still produce what researchers call disparate impact, unequal harm distributed unequally. As researchers at MIT explain in their book entitled Fairness and Machine Learning, this is a known limitation. A model trained on incomplete representation will perform less reliably for the groups that it saw least. The fix is not to blame the algorithm, but to train it better, more representative data, and to test its error rate across different customer groups before deployment. What makes these cases worse is the lack of any information. When a loan officer denies your mortgage application, the law requires a written explanation. But when an algorithm declines your debit card, you get a flagged by our system message. If you're lucky enough to connect with a human representative, they can't tell you much more. This gap is not an accident. Most high-performing fraud modules are black boxes. Their internal logic is not designed for human interpretation. A bank may genuinely be unable to articulate plainly why your transaction was stopped. That's not because it's hiding something, but because the model itself doesn't produce a reason. It produces a number. So in response, many financial institutions are moving towards tools that make their algorithms more transparent. Known in the industry as explainable AI, these systems are designed to surface the most influential factors behind a given decision, flagging, for instance, that a transaction was blocked because of an unusual location, combined with a typically large amount. It's a meaningful step toward accountability. However, these adoptions are pretty uneven, and the explanations that do exist are rarely surfaced to customers. Meanwhile, these pressures have not yet translated into a consistent, enforceable right to a meaningful explanation when your card gets declined. For most people, the path of least resistance is simply to move on, switch to another card, take their business elsewhere, or say nothing. Research suggests a quarter of consumers who experience a false decline never return to that merchant at all. Some people go further. They close the account entirely. And that instinct is understandable. However, it does carry a hidden cost. A declined transaction won't appear on your credit report, but closing the card can. Shutting down an account reduces your available credit and can shorten your credit history, which can directly affect your credit score. So what can you do right now? Well, you have more power here than the banks would like you to think. First off, call your bank immediately. A fraud flag is probabilistic, not final. A bank representative can override a declined transaction in real time. The model made a guess, but a human can correct it. Do not wait. Number two, set alerts if you're planning to make unusual purchases. Most banks allow you to notify them of upcoming travel, large purchases, or some changes in your spending pattern. This gives the model new information to work with, which can prevent the flag from triggering in the first place. And number three, know your rights. Under the Fair Credit Billing Act, you can dispute transaction blocks and request an explanation. If you believe you have been systematically and unfairly blocked, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau accepts consumer complaints. Ask your bank what appeal processes are available. Increasingly, banks are building more customer-facing appeal services. Visa reported 106 million disputes globally in 2025. That's a 35% rise since 2019, and has called dispute management a strategic priority. Improper declines are expensive for payment companies and financial institutions as well, through customer service cost and lost revenue and eroded trust. But the bigger picture? Well, the algorithm that blocked your payment is not all-knowing or neutral. It's a machine making a statistical guess about you based on data that was probably never perfectly fair to begin with. As AI spreads further into our daily lives, the question of who controls these decisions and whether we can challenge them becomes ever more urgent. And that was the article, Your Declined Card May Be AI's Fault. Our second article, the bottom of the economy page, Harley-Davidson Prepares for Customization Push, written by Ricardo Torres for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Customization has always been a part of Harley-Davidson's culture, and the motorcycle maker is preparing a major push for its parts and accessories in the year 2027. Harley-Davidson CEO Artie Starrs said customization is a critical part of the company's efforts to return to growth. Starrs made that comment during a July 23rd earnings call with analysts and investors. He said, quote, customization is not an add-on to the Harley-Davidson experience. It is core to the Harley-Davidson experience. It drives rider connection. It creates important opportunities for our dealers and supports a stronger and more diversified revenue model for the motor company, unquote. Harley-Davidson reported a profit of $80 million, which is a 26% decline from the second quarter in 2025. But still, the company did ship 39,200 motorcycles. That's a 9% increase from the year before. And it had a revenue of $1.1 billion. That's a 6% increase from 2025. And worldwide, the company saw a 1% increase in units sold with 42,500 motorcycles. But that said, in the second quarter, the parts and accessories segment of Harley-Davidson was down 5% to just $177 million compared to the same point in the year prior in 2025. Customization plays a role in the strategy to increase growth, and Harley-Davidson has also taken feedback from dealerships. Keith Ulicki, who is owner of Uke's Harley-Davidson in Kenosha, Wisconsin, said the company putting a greater emphasis on customization is good for dealerships. Ulicki said, quote, "That's been missing. They've been letting the aftermarket companies come in and take that market over. So it's good that they're coming out with the parts," unquote. And Harley-Davidson, quote, "produces the bike. So when they come out with new models, they can come out with parts and accessories right away because they have the jump on everybody," unquote. And then he added, "It's about time they changed that." Ulicki said he believes riders are going to respond well to the new strategy. He said, quote, "Instead of looking at the internet or through a computer, they can see the parts in stock and see what they are. Anything, accessories, any customized piece that's not on a standard bike, they can see and customize themselves," unquote. And that was the article, "Harley-Davidson Prepares for Customization Push." Well, those are our two articles from the economy page. We're coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section of the paper. Want to read what's on the front page of it. Well, the cover story from the sports section was written by Jose M. Romero. "These huge sporting events are coming to Metro Phoenix." Few places in the U.S. have the tradition, infrastructure, climate, and hospitality industry like Metro Phoenix, especially when it comes to hosting major sports events. The annual Fiesta Bowl at State Farm Stadium has turned into a college football playoff game. In recent years, the stadium has hosted the NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four, Super Bowl 57, and International Soccer's CONCACAF Gold Cup and Copa America. Mortgage Matchup Center hosted the Women's Final Four in April, and along with the Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale, has hosted numerous major boxing and pro wrestling events in recent years. Here are more major sporting events to take place in Metro Phoenix this year and into next. Noche UFC, Saturday, September 12th, 2 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, Desert Diamond Arena. UFC's celebration of Mexican Independence Day comes to Desert Diamond Arena for the first time, featuring a card highlighted by Mexican and Latino talent, including former champions, rising prospects, and fan favorites. With the NFL, the Seahawks at the Cardinals on Sunday, September 20th at 1:25 p.m., State Farm Stadium, the Arizona Cardinals will host the defending Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks in Arizona's 2026 home opener, also the second regular season game of the season. Will the Arizona Diamondbacks earn a wild card spot in the Major League Baseball postseason? Despite the NL West title seeming out of reach, the team continues to chase a National League playoff spot. If they get in, both NL best of three wild card series start on Tuesday, September 29th, at the home of the higher seed, which will host all games at its home stadium. If the Diamondbacks don't get the number one wild card, the first chance they would have to host a postseason game at Chase Field would be in a division series Game 3 on October 6th. Saturday, October 3rd, 7 p.m. at State Farm Stadium, U.S. versus Mexico men's soccer friendly match. The biggest international soccer rivalry in North America will write another chapter in Glendale, where the U.S. men's national team and El Tri have played some memorable matches. Mexico leads the overall series and will feel right at home in Arizona, where it's likely that most of the crowd will be on its side. You can expect a big crowd of 50,000 or more. NASCAR's fall race in Phoenix. Sunday, October 18th at noon, Freeway Insurance 500, the Phoenix Raceway. The series makes its second stop this season, October 16th through the 18th at Phoenix Raceway, as the Cup Series playoffs continue. Friday night, October 16th, features the truck races. Saturday is the O'Reilly Auto Parts Series event, and the top names in the sport battle it out in the Cup Series showdown, the Freeway Insurance 500, on Sunday, October 18th. Sunday, October 25th, 1:05 p.m. State Farm Stadium. The Cardinals will honor Hall of Fame wide receiver Larry Fitzgerald at halftime of their game against the Denver Broncos. In a ceremony that day, Fitzgerald will be placed in the team's Ring of Honor and also have his jersey number 11 retired. The Cactus Bowl, Saturday, December 26th, 5:30 p.m., Mountain America Stadium, formerly the Rate Bowl, originally the Cactus Bowl, the annual college bowl game, will move from Chase Field to Mountain America Stadium in Tempe this year. The showdown will pit the Big 12 Conference against the Big 10 Conference. Suns versus Philadelphia 76ers. Wednesday, December 30th, 7 p.m., Mortgage Matchup Center. Come celebrate LeBron James' 42nd birthday at the Suns' only regular season home game against Philly. Then there's the VRBO Fiesta Bowl. Wednesday, December 30th, 5:30 p.m., State Farm Stadium. This year's Fiesta Bowl will be a college football playoff quarterfinal game. Thursday, December 31st, 7 p.m., Mortgage Matchup Center. The only visit to Phoenix from the defending NBA champions this season, the New York Knicks, will be on New Year's Eve. And then there's the WWE Royal Rumble, February 2027, State Farm Stadium. The details have yet to be announced, but one of the signature WWE pay-per-views is coming to town. It will be the 40th Royal Rumble and will feature many big names in the industry. In WWE's signature 30-man and 30-woman Royal Rumble matches, the winner of each earns a championship match opportunity at WrestleMania 43. And then we have NASCAR and IndyCar races. March 12th through the 14th, 2027, Phoenix Raceway. The NASCAR O'Reilly Auto Parts Series and the NTT IndyCar Series races will take place in a weekend doubleheader. Action will begin on Friday, March 12th with an ARCA Menards Series race, and it will conclude on Sunday, March 14th with the NASCAR Cup Series race. And the IndyCar race will be Saturday, March 13th. And then the PBR World Finals, May 20th to the 23rd on 2027. Desert Diamond Arena, 4 days of high-stakes competition, will bring the world's best bull riders and toughest bulls to the Desert Diamond Arena with a world championship on the line. And that was the article by Jose Romero. These huge sporting events are coming to Metro Phoenix. Our next article is about the WNBA, written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. Mercury host 3 games before World Cup break. The Phoenix Mercury have 3 home games remaining before taking a 3-week break for the upcoming World Cup in Berlin, Germany. The Mercury will have several representatives at the World Cup, which will run from September 4th through the 13th. Guards Kalia Copper and Kelsey Plum will represent the United States. Forward Valeriane Ayea will represent France, and guard Sammy Whitcomb will represent Australia. This week, the Mercury will host the Washington Mystics in back-to-back games on Tuesday, August 25th and Thursday, August 27th. And will welcome the Toronto Tempo on Saturday, August 29th. The Mystics buried the Mercury in their first meeting in August 9th with Sonia Citron knocking down 5 3-pointers on 6 attempts in the 20-point rout. Shakira Austin had a double-double with 19 points and 11 rebounds. Toronto and Phoenix last faced each other on June 27th without some key players. The Tempo's duo of Marina Mabry and Brittany Sykes were both out, while the Mercury did not have Alyssa Thomas. Kalia Copper posted 27 points in the Mercury's 89-80 win. Entering Phoenix's Saturday, August 22nd home matchup against the Atlanta Dream, Copper was averaging 20.5 points per game, while Alyssa Thomas was contributing 14.9 points and 8.2 assists and 7.5 rebounds per game. And that was the article, Mercury host 3 games before World Cup break. And our next article is about Diamondback baseball. D-backs move past MART issues, dust Reds, by Nick Pecoro and Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. Not only did the Diamondbacks have to endure 3 days of Ketel Marte's drama in Boston earlier this week, they also had a travel snafu that forced them to spend a night in Las Vegas on their way home to Phoenix. But there were no signs that any of it bothered them on Friday night, August 21st, as they thumped the Cincinnati Reds 9-0 in the opener of a 6-game homestand at Chase Field. Jordan Lawler had 3 hits, including a home run, and left-hander Eduardo Rodriguez fired 5 2/3 scoreless innings. The Diamondbacks led from the start, getting a run-scoring single from Gabriel Moreno in the first inning. Lawler's 2-run homer highlighted a 3-run second inning, and the Diamondbacks added single runs in the 3rd and 4th innings to build a 6-0 lead. They added 3 more later in the game. The Diamondbacks collected 15 hits and 5 walks, stole 4 bases, played a clean game defensively, and received 3 1/3 innings of hitless relief work. Manager Tory Lavullo said, quote, "Today's a perfect example of what the D-backs can do. 1 through 26, everybody got on their assignments, did their job, and we won a baseball game," unquote. The Diamondbacks have moved to 68 and 61. They remain a game behind the San Diego Padres for the 3rd and final wild card spot. Now, thunderstorms in the Phoenix area on Wednesday night, August 19th, forced the Diamondbacks team plane to divert to Las Vegas. That's where they spent the night before completing their trip home the next day. Lawler said the travel was pretty crazy. "We thought we're getting into Phoenix after the 5-hour Boston flight. Next thing you know, you just feel the plane keep doing circles," unquote. Lavullo said, quote, "We managed. We've been dealing with a lot. That's what we do. It's part of our culture. It's about adjusting, adapting, and going out there and performing as a team," unquote. Rodriguez was not at his best. His stuff was down across the board, something he attributed to being tired from the travel the previous couple of days. But he did still manage to pitch well enough to win. He said, quote, "I went out there, tried to do the best we can. I felt like my pitches were there, just felt like my body was a little tired. My fastball wasn't there. But today, the changeup was working great, and we took advantage of it, and I wound up going 5 2/3, unquote. Now, Diamondbacks manager Tory Lavullo said he was ready to move forward from this week's drama with second baseman Ketel Marte, offering bits and pieces of information about Mart's 6 shocking failure to show up at the ballpark earlier in the week. Lavullo told reporters on Friday, August 23rd, quote, "maybe a little bit of frustration built around the injury," unquote. And then he went on and said, quote, "at some point, I'm hopeful he'll be able to explain that directly to you guys," unquote. Mart did not show up to Fenway Park in Boston on Monday, August 17th, for the Diamondbacks game that night against the Boston Red Sox, and was placed on the restricted list. He was moved to the injured list on Thursday, August 20th, after undergoing an MRI and receiving an injection in his knee. Lavullo said, quote, "we were able to say things that we needed to say to one another, and we're going to turn the page on this as quickly as possible and get Cattell back in a healthy frame of mind from a physical standpoint and allow him to go out and help us win baseball games here in Arizona as soon as possible, unquote. Now, without going into specifics, Lavulo said Mart acknowledged during the meeting he could have handled himself better this week, likely a reference to the fact that Mart barely communicated with the organization for much of the week. Lavulo admitted in Boston that he had reached out to Mart multiple times without getting a response. Lavulo said, quote, "There's right ways to handle things and wrong ways to handle things, and I think the conclusion that was drawn up yesterday is that we could have been better, and Cattell could have been better, specifically and admittedly so," unquote. Lavulo also said he could have been better, perhaps referring to the way he handled Mart as he dealt with knee discomfort last weekend. Because Mart exited the Diamondbacks game against the Atlanta Braves on August 14th in the bottom of the second inning due to left knee soreness. He did not play August 15th, but he returned to the lineup the following day. Lavulo said, quote, "I need to probably communicate a little better at all times inside of my personal life and professional life, and sometimes I fall short. Maybe there's a connection there with me lacking communication and stepping out and understanding him in this situation. That might have added to the frustration a little bit. But overall, we can all be better in every single area. Cattell has been busting hard. He's played a lot of baseball games this year. If you go back and look at his full body of work, he's gotten after it. I think he got tired. He got frustrated by a few things that I want to keep personal, and we're going to work through that," unquote. Lavulo said Mart began a rehab program on Friday at Salt River Fields. Like Hazen the day before, Lavulo sounded hopeful that Mart could be back shortly after spending the minimum 10 days on the IL list. If that is the case, his first game back would be August 31st, versus the Philadelphia Phillies. In an interview on SiriusXM's Power Alley earlier in the day, Lavulo said he would like Mart to apologize to his teammates upon his return. When given the chance, Lavulo did not say the same to reporters at Chase Field. The clubhouse was partially populated during the hour in which reporters were allowed inside. Third baseman Nolan Arenado declined to comment. Outfielder Ryan Waldschmidt said he would welcome Mart back whenever Mart was ready. Reliever Kevin Ginkle offered the most thoughtful remarks, admitting to frustration about the way things went down in Boston, but also noted how important Mart is to the team's chances for success. Ginkle said, quote, "It's disappointing how the things that happened happen. There's really no explanation for it," unquote. Ginkle was asked if he would like Mart to offer some kind of explanation for his disappearance. And Ginkle said, quote, "I think it'd be nice to hear it, for sure. I think a lot of players are kind of frustrated with how it just happened. I think first and foremost it's him getting his knee right and mentally being in a good place where he can help contribute." And then he added, "For us to go where we want to go, we have got to have him here," unquote. And that was the article, D-backs move past Mart issues, dust Reds. We're coming up on 34 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the viewpoint section and read some opinion pieces. Our first opinion piece is entitled, "Arizona Anti-Bias Law Faces Test Before Supreme Court." This was written by Owen Anderson, a guest columnist. What would you do if your employer ordered you to do something that state law explicitly says it may not require? As a professor at Arizona State University, I found myself in exactly that situation. ASU required me to complete a diversity, equity, and inclusion employee training program that I believe violated state law and promoted discriminatory ideas about race and sex. So I went to court. And then came the twist. The state's lawyers argued that even if ASU violated my rights, I had no right to sue to enforce the law. When my case reaches the Arizona Supreme Court on September 1st, The justices will confront a question much larger than DEI. At stake is a basic question of democracy and government accountability. What recourse do Arizonans have when the government violates a law meant to restrain it? Arizona law is unusually clear. The state and its agencies may not require employees to participate in training that presents, quote, blame or judgment on the basis of race, ethnicity, or sex, unquote, and it prohibits using public money for such training. I took the Arizona Board of Regents to court to enforce that protection. But the regents contend that even if I am right, I cannot sue because the law does not expressly give employees that right. Under that theory, a state employee could be protected by law on paper, yet have no recourse when the state violates that protection. The trial court allowed my claim to proceed, but the Arizona Court of Appeals reversed, concluding that the law does not give employees the right to sue. And now it's up to the Arizona Supreme Court to make it clear that if a legal right exists, so does the right to enforce it. Now that may sound like an obscure procedural dispute, but it is not. It goes to the heart of what representative government requires, that government be accountable to the people it serves and bound by the laws meant to restrain it. The legislature did not merely recommend that state agencies avoid race-based blame. It said the state may not require employees to undergo such training. If an employee subjected to allegedly unlawful training cannot ask a court to stop the violation, the law has become a dead letter. The implications reach far beyond me. Legislatures routinely enact laws restricting what government agencies may do. Those restrictions mean considerably less if the people directly subjected to the prohibited conduct cannot invoke the courts when an agency ignores them. Today, the dispute happens to involve a professor and a DEI training program. But the same principle could arise under a different law protecting a teacher, a whistleblower, a police officer, or another public employee. The political controversy may change. The fundamental question does not mean if the government can violate the prohibition without the person protected by it having a way to enforce it. A law without an effective means of enforcement risks becoming little more than advice to the government. My lawsuit does not ask the courts to invent a new policy toward DEI. The Arizona legislature already made that policy judgment when it decided that government employees should not be required to participate in training presenting certain forms of racial, ethnic, or sexual blame, and taxpayers should not be forced to fund it. Whatever one thinks of whiteness, decolonization, intersectionality, or DEI more broadly, the principle at stake should not depend on whether one agrees with my views on those subjects. That is why this case matters to Arizonans who have never heard of ASU's Inclusive Communities program or have no interest in the culture wars surrounding DEI. Representative government depends not merely on legislators passing laws, but on government agencies obeying them. The Arizona Supreme Court's decision will determine more than whether my case proceeds. It will help decide whether, quote, the state may not, unquote, is an enforceable limit on government, or is it merely words on a page. And that was an opinion piece written by Owen Anderson, who's a professor of philosophy and religion at Arizona State University. He's also the author of the book, The Declaration of Independence and God. And that was entitled, Arizona Anti-Bias Law Faces Test Before Supreme Court. Well, we're at 40 minutes past the hour. I don't think we have enough time to do either of the other two viewpoints. So I think we're going to switch over to the letters to the editor and read some viewpoints from people like, you and me. Our first letter to the editor goes like this. The opinion piece entitled Arizona's Water Crisis Isn't a Growth Problem correctly notes that housing developments consume less water per acre than agriculture. However, framing sprawl as a water conservation strategy ignores the broader environmental cost. Replacing farmland with subdivisions trades water scarcity for increased urban heat islands, lost open space, and unchecked developer profits. Furthermore, this dynamic creates a perverse incentive for residents. Conservation efforts lose public support when saved water is used to justify further expansion. Arizona's water policy remains structurally flawed, built on rosy scenarios, unwanted assumptions, and denial. We must stop prioritizing developer interest and critically evaluate the long-term sustainability of continuous growth. Signed, Thomas Klablund from Tempe. Our next letter goes, I have been enjoying the extensive coverage in the Arizona Republic of our native tribes. In the August 2nd Sunday edition, Joan Miner's fine article on Navajo activist Nicole Horseherder was very informative, and Deborah Otasia Kroll's description of the Yurok tribe's efforts to restore tribal lands near the Klamath River Basin in California was fascinating and educational. Thank you for continuing to inform us. The indigenous people have too long been ignored and abused, and they deserve so much better. Signed, Diane Kennedy Pike in Scottsdale. Our next letter goes, regarding the August 9th inspiration piece regarding putting up bolted climbing routes. In the early 1970s, Yvonne Chouinard, owner of Patagonia, and friends in Yosemite developed climbing chocks to be used instead of bolting a route, which is considered unethical. This development, as known as clean climbing, is an alternative to bolts, so the rock is not defaced by bolts. Chocks are hexagonal metal pieces of metal that the leader jams into cracks as protection from falling. The principle is the same as bolts. The use of bolts for protection is discouraged by most of the climbing community. Signed, David Mowry in Glendale. Hats off to people like Antonio Morales Jr., who do what they can for water conservation. It is also a bit sad that while there are good people like Mr. Morales doing what they can to save, our state is allowing microchip factories, AI data centers, and developers to continue sucking our water supplies dry. Maybe there are some locations based on geographic conditions that can't handle any more residents or industry. Signed, Joseph Zenzuji from Phoenix. Our next letter goes, as a veteran, I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. As we mark the anniversary of its signing on September 17, 1787, I call on my fellow veterans to honor that oath through civic action. Unlimited dark money and foreign-backed interest are flooding our elections, bending public policy to agendas. Across the political spectrum, Americans are uniting around a cause that transcends political parties, a constitutional amendment to restore the state's ability to set reasonable limits on money in elections. 25 states, both red and blue, have already answered the call, passing non-binding resolutions urging Congress to propose such an amendment. Fellow veterans, we no longer wear the uniform, but our fight is not over. With your state and federal representatives, urge them to do everything in their power to make this amendment a reality. Signed, Fred Burrell from Green Valley. After the near elimination of two Utah National Monuments, Arizona could be next. It was already reported last year that the administration is looking to downsize or eliminate 6 national monuments in particular. 2 were those in Utah, and 2 were in Arizona's own Banawav Itakakveni ancestral footprints of the Grand Canyon and Ironwood Forest right outside Tucson. Having lived much of my life in Arizona and the Grand Canyon, including as its superintendent, I know firsthand the value of Arizona's public lands bring, and that we cannot allow the administration to continue down this dangerous path. Not only are Arizona's monuments crucial for our wildlife, for tribal nations, and for our economy, and for everyone's enjoyment of our iconic landscapes, but Arizonans simply don't want this. An overwhelming 93% believe monument designations should remain in place. The Grand Canyon itself began as a monument first, and this administration has neither the legal standing nor the public support to gut these hallowed lands. I have spent over 34 years with the National Park Service, including time as superintendent of Saguaro National Monument and Grand Canyon National Park. Signed, Rob Arnberger in Tucson. We're at 46 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over from the viewpoint section and go on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. We will begin with Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. The pressure is on in both your home life and career world. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th. Are you emotionally invested in the conversation? The stakes can feel high in a debate. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, are you aggressively protecting your resources? Sharing may not be on your agenda. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, a close relationship may test your patience today. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, your energy may feel low even though the to-do list is mounting. So is exhaustion catching up with you? For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, social expectations may interfere with what you really want to be doing. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates. Pay attention to your needs, even if the world seems demanding. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates. Appointed conversation challenges your perspective today. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates. Interpersonal tensions run high today. Do you feel like people want more than you are willing to give? For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdays, someone else's reaction challenges your composure today. Listen to their needs without putting up emotional armor. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdays, is agitation creeping in? Accumulative stress may begin to take over. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Crankiness may set in when the group goes against your desired agenda. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my best friend and I got pregnant, each with our first child, with our due dates a week apart. We felt blessed to be going through this amazing experience at the same time. Our babies are now 2 months old. I am adjusting well to motherhood. I feel it's coming natural to me. But my friend is having the opposite experience. Ever since the birth of her daughter, she has been distant, anxious, and depressed. She's a different person. I don't know how to help her. I don't know what she's going through. To make matters worse, she told me that when I make comments about being super happy and loving breastfeeding as she struggles with it, she thinks I am rubbing it in her face. How do I support her and still be forthcoming about my own positive experience. Signed, one of two new moms. And Abigail responds, Dear one, there may be a physiological cause for your friend's anxiety and depression. Childbirth can lead to a hormonal imbalance that can be corrected. It's important that she talk to her obstetrician about the negative emotions that she is experiencing. Please don't wait to urge her to do this, because the problem could worsen. And allow me to offer a final thought. You would be a more sensitive friend to her if you share your joy at being a new mother with friends other than this one, at least for a while. You don't need to censor your social media, but please find other things to talk about when face-to-face with her. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, my husband and I have friends that we consider our BFF couple. The husband, Brian, recently became unemployed, which has left him more time to travel. Brian and his wife fly to see his dad in Florida several times a year. Although they live an hour closer to the airport than we do, Brian asks every time for my husband to drive them to and from the airport. Now, my husband's retired, so his schedule is a bit freer than most, but now he's driving much longer to drop off and pick up than it would take this couple to use Uber, or even better, park their car in remote parking. It's not a financial issue for them because they fly on his dad's points, and Brian's wife makes twice what I do. I have argued with my husband over this and told him he doesn't need to be their cab driver simply because they feel entitled to his time and are too lazy to park their car at the airport. The wear and tear on our car and the promises of gas money that never appears exacerbate my frustration. Am I wrong to stand my ground on this issue with my husband? Signed, Not Your Cabbie. And Abigail responds, Not Your Cabbie. I agree that this couple could stand to be more self-sufficient and considerate, but your husband's time is his to spend as he pleases. As long as he doesn't break any engagements with you to help them out, why not just admire his generous spirit? And that said, given recent gas prices, you might suggest that he collect the gas money up front moving forward. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. And now let's look at some of the Sunday comics. In the comic strip Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, in the first frame, Mom is in the kitchen and she says, I can't find any aluminum foil. And Jeremy walks by and says, Oh, I might have used it all, as he looks at his phone. And Mom turns to him and says, All of it? For what? And he says, Well, to cover my bedroom windows. And in the next frame, Mom says, But that will completely block out any daylight, and it'll mess with your circadian rhythms, sweetie. It would be so dark in there that you might sleep through the entire weekend. And in the last frame, as he walks away, he says, I'm glad you see the potential, too. And that was Zits. And then in the comic strip, Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in the first frame, Sergeant Snorkel says, We're moving out, Beetle. And it looks like most of the guys have climbed into the back of the big army truck, and Beetle was asleep in his pup tent, and now he's rolled it up, and in the second frame he says, Well, hey, wait for me. And Sergeant Snorkel says, Too late, you're walking back. And in the third frame, Beetle starts to cry and says, It's too hot, I'll burn up. And then in the next frame, the truck pulls away. Beetle gets out his phone, tap, 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 tap. And in the last frame, here comes Beetle right behind the army truck in an Uber. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then with Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, in the first frame, Dagwood comes in the house and Blondie says, Herb loaned you his new wrench? And Dagwood says, Yep, and he buys nothing but the best for his brand new tow box. In the next frame, Dagwood's underneath the kitchen sink. All you can do is see his legs sticking out from underneath the sink. Blondie's looking at him. Daisy the dog is there looking at him. And we hear bang, bang underneath the sink, and then dang. And then more in the next frame, more bang, bang, bang. And from underneath the sink, Dagwood says, "Come on, loosen up." And then in the next frame, clank. And Dagwood goes, "Uh-oh, oops." And in the last frame, Herb is on the phone, and we hear from the phone, "Hey, buddy. Do you have a few minutes to run to the hardware store with me?" And Herb says, "Only if it includes a shiny new wrench and lunch at the new wing place right next door." And that was Blondie. In the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, it's nighttime. They're getting out of the family van. And Mom says to Hammy, "Go brush your teeth, put your pajamas on. I'll be in a couple of minutes." He sounds kind of tired. And Zoe's walking away going yawning. And then Dad starts to wake up baby Wren, and Mom says, "Wait, Daryl, don't wake Wren." He goes, "What?" She says, "If she opens her eyes, she won't get to sleep for 2 hours." And Dad says, "Well, we can't leave her alone in the van." And Mom says, "Oh, I know that." And Dad says, "Well, so what do you want me to do?" In the last frame, there's baby Wren asleep in the car seat. Dad is stretched out in the driver's seat, and he thinks to himself, "First off, I shouldn't have called Tails." And that was Baby Blues. Well, I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. Have a great day.